This is a reading of a collection of lectures by Rudolf Steiner entitled The Christ Impulse and the Development of Ego Consciousness. This is Lecture 6, The Birth of Conscience. In the lectures given here last winter, we considered the Christ being from many different aspects and in various ways, endeavored to point out that what we know as the Christ Impulse is the most powerful factor for the development of mankind that has ever occurred in the evolution of the earth. It is therefore easy to understand that this subject can never be exhausted, that there can be no end to all one might do to elucidate the Christ impulse from all sides. Moreover, when all is said and done, all that is of profoundest interest to man is really connected with the appearance of Christ. We saw that the Gospels attempted to approach the subject of the being of Christ from four different sides, and we touched upon several of their secrets. As it was, we were only able to throw a limited light on the Matthew Gospel. It must be put aside for the present, but we shall return to its secrets at a later time. Then we can venture further into the depths of St. Mark's Gospel. If we were now at the conclusion of our winter lectures in this group, to give some sketchy indications of what remains to be discussed, it would upset the harmony of later lectures. Today, therefore, and also in our next lecture, we will touch upon questions that relate to the Christ problem in a certain respect, that is, the connection between human conscience and the intervention of the Christ impulse in the development of mankind. In so doing, we will also achieve another objective. Next Thursday, a public lecture will be given on human conscience, the same subject we will take up today. There is a definite purpose in this, which, as time goes on, will often be apparent to our spiritual vision, because it will be shown that the same subject can be spoken of in a different way in a study group such as this than in a public lecture intended for people who are not members of our movement. The anthroposophist must, among many other capacities, acquire a feeling for how matters concerning the world can be approached from many different standpoints, and he must realize also that one who has already mastered certain basic facts can both speak and hear of a subject in a different way from one who has not. When we speak to a study group, we assume that those present have been accustomed to hear of the conceptions of a spiritual world. In their thoughts and feelings, they are already in that world, and should be able to form a concept of human conscience. Thus the answers to questions can be drawn from much greater depths in a study group than in a public lecture given to a non-anthroposophical audience. Such public lectures are intended to give a sort of proof by means of the phenomena of the soul life introduced as external experience that the truths of spiritual science are truths indeed. This is a different task for the student of spiritual science, who probably brings with him certain inner convictions and opinions about the spiritual world. He must gradually learn to become acquainted with ideas and concepts from many different sources. This will make certain things clear to him. He must also stop observing and speaking of things only in one way, even though that is the method that still prevails in external life. The question of human conscience is one that must touch the very depths of our souls. For centuries, philosophers and thinkers throughout the world have been interested in this subject. Regarding the phenomenon of conscience, however, one might easily succumb to the illusion, which has often been described here, of believing that everything that is to be found in the human soul today was always to be found in it. Yet as we know the various soul faculties and processes that have been developed in man throughout thousands of years were quite different in primeval times from what they are now. We did not possess much of what is most prized in our soul lives today when we lived on earth thousands of years ago in other incarnations. There is a purpose in our many incarnations, as we have often emphasized, which is that the soul should acquire ever new capacities and forces in the course of its development from one incarnation to another. Its earth existence should be a time of learning, and we should realize that it was not the same at the time of the beginning of our incarnations as it is now. Moreover, in the distant future, it will again be different. Human conscience, too, that precious possession of the human soul, which speaks like the voice of God in every man and woman, informing them of good or evil, even this precious gift was not always present in man's inner being. Thus conscience has also developed, and it is not so long ago, comparatively speaking, that its presence first became known. Nevertheless, precious as this possession is to us, it is not intended that it should remain in the human soul in its present form for all time to come. It will develop further and take different forms, ultimately proving to be something man had to acquire that will bear fruit. In later ages, when these fruits are his, it will be something man will look back upon, saying that there once was a time when, in the course of his passage through different incarnations, he was able to embody his conscience in his soul, and that now he is enjoying its fruits. We now look back to a time when our souls were in other incarnations and did not possess conscience. But in future times our souls will look back at the present and exclaim, "Hail to that past! Thanks for the gifts that became our conscience in the past. If we had not then had been able to develop conscience in our souls, we should now lack what we need for our present lives." So we see that conscience at the present time forms part of the treasures of the soul. And if we understand something of the nature and being of this conscience, it gives us a particular understanding of our age and its psychic life. Man's conscience came into being, a fact we have often referred to, and in the public lecture next Thursday I shall say that one can even point, as it were, to the time when conscience was first discovered in the human soul. If we go back into ancient Greece about 500 years before Christ, we come to the time of the great poet Aeschylus. When we let the characters depicted by the powerful genius of this old Greek dramatist work upon us, we are unable to find what is today called conscience. 500 years before the Christian era, the greatest dramatist then alive had no word to express what we now call human conscience. When he wanted to express what corresponds to our present-day conscience, however, he did so as follows. If a man committed the sin of murdering his mother, for example, he was, through the forcefulness of the event, made to see into the spiritual worlds. There he perceived certain figures that were known to the ancient Greeks as Erinus, and later to the Romans as Furies. Thus, according to Aeschylus, a man who had committed the evil deed of murdering his mother did not, as he would today, hear the reproachful voice of conscience in his inner being. But something drove him to spiritual vision, and he saw the avengers of his deed around him. Here is one of the remarkable proofs to be found in the historical development of what has just been asserted, namely, that in times past the capacities of the human soul were quite different. We have repeatedly emphasized that only gradually has the soul developed to its present ability to perceive the physical world through the senses and to use the intellect as today. We have said that in ancient times the soul possessed a certain clairvoyance as a normal capacity. At the time of Aeschylus, this only occurred in special cases. It became clairvoyant, for instance, when it was to see what it had brought about in the physical world through doing wrong. Thus the soul of Orestes became clairvoyant after the murder of his mother, and he then saw the spirits he had aroused in the spiritual world by his deed. They encompassed his soul on all sides. There was nothing of the nature of conscience in his soul. A clairvoyant consciousness set in, however, that enabled him to see the disorder brought about in the spiritual world by the wrong he had committed. We find in ancient times that when an evil deed was done, no voice of conscience was heard. In those days the soul was in a clairvoyant condition and could thus see the consequences of a wrong in the external world. What then occurs when a wrong is done? Something is brought about by us in the spiritual world. It is a purely materialistic belief that a wrong can be committed without affecting the spiritual world. Wrongs produce quite definite processes there. Effects radiate from us, invisible to sense perception, that can be clearly seen with spiritual sight. These spiritual processes that radiate from one who has done wrong provide nourishment for certain spiritual beings of the spiritual world. These beings cannot approach men at all times. They can only do so when the radiations resulting from evil actions emanate from them. The situation is the same as that of a clean or dirty room. If a room is clean, no flies will enter it, but if food or dirt is left about, the flies come to it immediately. So the moment a man radiates certain spiritual emanations because of his evil actions, he is surrounded by beings who feed on them. These are the beings that the great Greek dramatist Aeschylus depicts around Orestes. What we today know as the inner voice was represented by Aeschylus in external forms because he was so conscious of it. He knew that in special cases a certain clairvoyant consciousness that was formerly the common possession of all men could still be aroused. There is always something remaining in later times of what existed previously, but it appears atavistically and only in abnormal cases. Shakespeare should not be blamed, however, for representing something that is of the nature of an externalized conscience. We need only trace Greek art a little further, from Aeschylus to Euripides, to find that Euripides's tragedies contained the idea of conscience. Thus, in the 500 years before Christ, we can see how the idea of conscience gradually came into being in Greece. Look where you will in the Old Testament for a word corresponding to what we today call conscience. You will find none. Conscience as a quality gradually arose in the human soul, and if we consider long rather than short periods of time, we find that it entered the soul at about the same time as the Christ impulse. We might say that conscience followed closely after the introduction of the Christ impulse and entered the historical development of the world almost like a shadow of it. To understand this, we must call to mind and make fruitful much that we have learned in the past years of what human conscience really is. If we wish to grasp in a deeper sense what conscience is, we must remember that particular period of time during which mankind, in the course of his development, was approaching the Christ impulse. It absorbed this impulse and gradually, as its development proceeded, passed into our own period. We know that three epochs of civilization in the development of man are spanned here: the Egypto-Chaldean, the Greco-Roman, and our own period. We may omit the two even earlier periods for the moment, because our souls were then too far removed from having even an inkling of what we mean today by the concept of conscience. In the Egypto-Chaldean civilization, a gradual preparation occurred of everything that subsequently achieved its greatest development in the Greco-Roman civilization, so that it became possible to reach and absorb the significant stimulus of the Christ impulse. The development of this impulse will continue in our present age, and it will proceed at an increasing rate into the next epoch. Now, if we recall more carefully the development of man from the Egypto-Chaldean epoch through the Greco-Roman into our own, it is clear that a different part of the human soul was developed in each of these epochs. The sentient soul was developed during the Egypto-Chaldean. This means that we had at one time to be incarnated in Egypto-Chaldean bodies, to be able properly to acquire those qualities that make possible the special development of the sentient soul. We then, as souls, took that quality with us into our next incarnations during the Greco-Roman period in order to develop the intellectual soul. In our present incarnations, with the fruits gained in the Greco-Roman period, we are enabled gradually to bring the forces of the consciousness soul to a higher stage of development. Thus have our souls been developed throughout these three periods. In future, in the sixth epoch of civilization, after our age is concluded, our souls will then rise to the development of the quality of spirit self. Here we see what a profound purpose lies in our going through successive incarnations. By their means we have gradually acquired the faculties that are familiar to us today, and in a larger sense those that extend beyond the mere life of the soul. Thus during the Egypto-Chaldean period our souls acquired the forces of the sentient soul and brought them to their full development. During the Greco-Roman period we developed the intellectual soul. This evolution through the development of the intellectual soul had to proceed normally for the Christ impulse to exercise its effects on us. Now, this development took place quite differently in different parts of the earth. If we believe that man's development takes place in the simplest way possible, we should never arrive at an understanding of it. A great deal must be learned before we can even begin to grasp the great thoughts of the guiding cosmic beings. It is simply arrogance and a love of ease that leads us to assert that the truth is simple, and it only shows that we want to twist the truth to suit our own convenience. Actually, the truth is complicated. The spirit of the guiding cosmic beings can only be grasped by us when we make the most intense efforts to plunge into their most subtle and intimate thoughts. So we ought not believe we have exhausted all knowledge when we say that our souls have gradually evolved through the Egyptian-Chaldean, Greco-Roman, and our own epochs. Let us transport ourselves for a moment to the Egypto-Chaldean civilization. There were, at that time, before the Greco-Roman period began, human beings also living in Greece and in the countries of the Roman Empire. During the Egypto-Chaldean period in Asia and Africa, human beings lived, too, on the soil we walk on today in our own countries. Now, while certain souls in Asia and Africa were more specifically preparing to receive the Christ impulse, others living in the regions of the later Greco-Roman were preparing something quite different to bring into the collective development of man. In our own countries, too, there were people who were preparing for something quite different still. Thus, not only do our souls acquire different qualities in successive ages, but during the same age they live together side by side. Different influences are brought to bear on souls in this way, causing further complications in evolution. By this means, however, more is brought into the development of humanity than if everything proceeded smoothly along a straight path. It is indeed a fact that preparations had also to be made in Greco-Roman lands, as well as our own, so that the right impulse might be brought into man's development from various sides. The peoples of Asia and Africa had one mission, those of Southern Europe another, and the peoples inhabiting Northern and Central Europe still another. All had quite different qualities to bring to the collective development of humanity. They were able to do so because both their gifts and their training were essentially different. When we turn our attention to the Egypto-Chaldean peoples, to the souls who reached the zenith of their development in that particular age, we must say that these peoples developed certain qualities of the sentient soul, qualities that could be specially developed by the absorption of the wonderful teaching that then flowed from the sacred centers of Egypt, or from the marvelous astrology that could be learned in a similar center in Chaldea. What flowed from the various centers was made available for the very purpose of aiding the soul's progress. The true meaning of what thus flowed forth was not to be found in the content of civilization's streams, but in what these centers contributed to the development of the human soul. The content passed away. Only those who, in a deeper sense, do not have all their wits about them can doubt that in a few centuries our contemporary science will have sunk just as far into oblivion as certain aspects of the Egypto-Chaldean civilization have today. Anyone who believes that the Copernican conception of the universe yields eternal verities is making a great mistake. In future, it will become a thing of the past, just as the achievements of ancient Egypt have today. As far as the contents of such things are concerned, they pass away, like many other things in the development of humanity. In that wonderful painting of the Last Supper of Leonardo da Vinci in Milan, for instance, only faint outlines are left, and we know that before long nothing will remain of this work into which da Vinci put his best efforts. Some day there will be just as little left of Raphael's works, which so move our souls today when we open ourselves to them. All these works of art will perish, and no memory of them will remain on the physical plane. Their contents will die like the contents of civilization. When we stand before these paintings, however, we ought to remember that they flowed out of Raphael's soul, and that after he had conjured them forth, his soul was changed thereby. Similarly, thousands of people who have been moved and uplifted by these paintings have been made different through the experience of them. Some day, when the whole earth crumbles into dust, as it certainly will, the external establishments of the various civilizations will expire. What souls have acquired from these various civilizations, however, is for their benefit and will pass over with them into eternity. What flowed forth from the sanctuaries of Egypt and Chaldea, what for that time was exalted wisdom, was poured into the souls of men. They were thereby brought a step further, and to the extent that they did advance, to that extent were they ripe to garner new treasures. In the Greco-Roman age, this helped them further still. If our souls had not absorbed what they did in Greco-Roman times, they could not now be living in the consciousness soul. That constitutes progress in time. If we recall various things said in the public lectures, we are aware that what we call the I, capital, the ego, works in the three soul principles. From the chaos of soul experiences encountered in the sentient, intellectual, and consciousness souls, the ego gradually develops and crystallizes. This development differs, however, in different parts of the earth. While the souls in Asia and Africa, for instance, were developing during the Egypto-Chaldean period through the long-lasting influences of the revelations of the Chaldean and Egyptian sanctuaries, the peoples in Europe, far removed geographically, developed in such a way that they were in a sense ahead of them. In the European countries, men had already developed the ego in the sentient soul, in a certain sense. They had developed a strong feeling for the ego. Here we come to an extremely important point. Those men who moved into Asia and Africa held back their egos until the influence of the Egyptian and Chaldean sacred knowledge could develop in the sentient soul. Souls were incarnated into these cultural regions, who absorbed their sublime teachings and lofty culture without having a distinct feeling of the ego nature. This lofty culture of the ancient Chaldea, and Egypt was poured into a sentient soul as yet unconscious of its ego. In the north, however, no such lofty culture existed to sink into the soul, and it therefore remained more or less uncultivated. In this very lack, this sentient soul that had never experienced the warm glow of the revelations pouring in from the sanctuary knowledge, developed the consciousness of an ego. We may say that among the peoples of Egypt and Chaldea, ego consciousness was late in coming. It waited until the sentient soul had absorbed a certain culture and the later soul principles had developed. In Europe, however, the ego did not delay. It developed immediately in the sentient soul and waited until the later soul principles had developed before absorbing certain qualities pertaining to the treasures of civilization. So we see that there were certain souls incarnated in Asia and Africa who had hardly any consciousness of their egos, but who were granted revelations of a high order in their sentient souls. While in Europe there were souls who lacked a lofty culture, but emphasized their individual egos. They could thereby look upon and feel themselves as men, as human individuals. The peoples of the Greek and Roman countries occupied a place central between the two extremes. They had the mission of developing the qualities of the intellectual soul. They developed the ego in it, and were also able to absorb certain forms of civilization into it. So the Egypto-Chaldean culture waited, holding back the ego for a later time. The European culture developed it early, and the Greco-Roman culture kept the balance, in a sense, by developing a certain civilization at the same time as it did the ego. In this way, we can divine a great mystery of our human development. Without knowledge of it, we can never understand why the Christ impulse could enter Europe with so little hindrance, and why it gained so much influence there. Why was this? Could Christ have appeared in Europe? Might he not have incarnated there in a physical body? No, that would have been impossible. He appeared in the Greco-Roman period, the time when the intellectual soul was developed. It was an age particularly well adapted to come forward to meet Christ. but he could not have made his appearance in Northern Europe because of the strong ego feeling prevailing there. This strong individual feeling of self was not adapted to produce an individual having the sole purpose of providing the physical vehicle to harbor the highest being. A premature and excessive feeling of the ego for the equality of man had developed in the countries of Europe. It would have been impossible there for one person to tower so high above his contemporaries as did the one who provided the vehicle for the Christ. The body fit for the Christ to occupy could contain no premature feeling of the I. He therefore had to appear on the borders of the Egypto-Chaldean and Greco-Roman cultures. There it was possible for a body to be formed that lacked the premature ego feeling, but that nevertheless possessed the profoundest comprehension of the spiritual world made possible by the Egypto-Chaldean cultures. If Europeans, however, lacked the power of preparing a body for the Christ because they had prematurely developed the ego in the dawn of the new life, yet they had, above all, the faculty to bring to mankind, after Christ had appeared, a full consciousness of the ego. This helped them to a full understanding of it. This was possible because the Europeans had acquired the feeling of the I too early, that had grown up with it, as it were. These things must be borne in mind if we wish to understand modern civilization. In Asia and Africa we find people who know much concerning world secrets, and who are skillful in setting up certain symbols, who have, in fact, cultivated their sentient souls in such a way that they have rich soul lives as a result. Their sense of ego is weak, however. In Europe we find people who have received less culture through revelations from without, but they are the type of men who look to themselves, finding the strongest support in themselves. So in Asia the ground was prepared for the coming of Christ. There a body could be found into which he could incarnate. In Europe we find the people prepared best to understand the bringer of ego consciousness. Christ brought to Europeans what they longed for. Hence it was in Europe that Christian mysticism developed, that wonderful mysticism in which men sought to draw Christ into their own souls, into their egos. In this way, through the wise guidance of the world, men were prepared in different parts of the earth, so that in each epoch of development what was right for that time should be found. One of the great assets to be acquired from studying the conception of the world presented by spiritual science is that we gain an increasingly strong sense of the wise way in which the development of humanity and of the world has been carried on. We see how for thousands of years souls were prepared on European soil so that they might develop as early as possible a firm center in their inner beings. For this purpose, they were actually kept back from acquiring the forces so highly evolved in Asia. Therefore, while a strong sense of the personal ego was being developed in Europe, a stream of culture flowed across from Asia. We can actually point out how the Adriatic constituted almost a boundary between a rather weak sense of self in Greece, where a man did not so much feel himself to be a separate individual, as he did an Athenian, Spartan, Theban, or member of his city, and the Roman culture, where the strong feeling of ego was developed in the consciousness of the Roman citizen, who stood firmly on his own ground as an individual person. In Greece we still find the nature of the ego to be somewhat retiring. Men still took in more from the outer world in such a way that the ego did not need to be present. When we cross the Adriatic to Rome, we find the Roman citizen standing firmly on his feet, already conscious of his ego. Deep and significant reasons are behind all this. These things do not occur on the physical plane without corresponding events taking place in the spiritual world. We see that in Grecian culture, a strong influence of the ego was still withheld, and much was still taken impersonally. The Greek did not feel himself to be a separate citizen, but rather a member of a city-state, such as Athens, Sparta, or Thebes. This feeling had to be destroyed. Man's longing to draw things into himself from without had to disappear. In future, as he gradually becomes more of a Westerner, he must learn to find entrance into the inner part of his soul. What is to be formed by the masses must be lived and experienced first by the great leaders, the great individualities of humanity. Let us keep before our minds the fact to which we have often referred, that the Greek still had a strong consciousness telling him that what was given him from without, apart from his having greatly developed his inner personality, was of particular value. Let me remind you once more of the saying of a cultured Greek that gives us a deep insight into the longings of the Greek people. A better to be a beggar in the upper world than a king in the realms of shades. The great value of the invisible, supersensible life had not been realized. What could be drawn from the environment without the help of the ego was drawn from it. It is profoundly moving to perceive how at this juncture and turning point of the times, a great leading personality stood like a signpost directing the shedding of the disposition of the past for the new, speaking words from the spiritual world, as it were, to ring forth far and wide. A time is now coming when men must no longer take into themselves what can flow into their personalities apart from their egos, but rather what enters them through their egos. This deed was accomplished by one of the great sages of ancient Greece. It was fulfilled in part by Empedocles on the island of Sicily. In many legends, which today are told only as stories, great depths lie concealed. Empedocles, the great sage, philosopher, and initiate of the deep mysteries of his time, was one of the world's greatest statesmen and also a sacrificial priest. The following legend concerning him is, in an occult sense, true. Having completed his task in Sicily, Empedocles threw himself into the volcano, Mount Etna, so that his external sheaths might be united with the soil of Sicily, to record thereby that firm faith in the ego would follow now that the external had disappeared. The sacrifice of the outer sheaths of Empedocles was accomplished when he surrendered them to Mount Etna. There is a deep occult truth behind this. Among the spiritual experiences to be gained in Sicily today, one can still trace the after-effects of the deed of Empedocles when one spiritually breathes the air there. His soul had continued to incarnate, but his body attained a special significance by having been consciously given over to the elements. It can still be found in the spiritual atmosphere of Sicily today. The body of Empedocles still forms a considerable part of the spiritual atmosphere of Sicily. It was an important moment for me, such things can be discussed within our groups, when I was able to tell our Palermo friends a few days ago that when one travels in Sicily with spiritual consciousness, one will certainly still breathe spiritually, even today, what has permeated the air there ever since the sacrificial death of Empedocles. So now we see that the boundary between East and West, which we, speaking in an external and spatial sense, have referred to as the Adriatic Sea, was indicated by a great leader of humanity. As he worked on in the West, he stripped off the principle by means of which man could grow in the East because he desired to preserve for the future development of man what is exalted above all the elements of the external physical plane. It is a profound experience to become aware of these distinctions. They show how, in regions widely separated geographically, a variety of effects are being prepared in order that the greatest development may be attained. It is through the cooperative effects of differentiation that the goal of the collective development of mankind must be attained. From this we can see that Christ, after having appeared in the East, moved to the West, there to be accepted by those who were made ready for him by a strong ego consciousness through which they might better understand what he brought. This is the secret of Christ's entrance into the West. He found there souls who were prepared for him, who accepted him. Thus in the East we see humanity doing everything possible to prepare a body, or corporeality, consisting of a physical, etheric, and astral bodies into which the Christ could penetrate. He who, together with and by means of ego consciousness, brought the impulse of love to the earth. Love, in its most psychic and spiritual form, came to earth with Christ. It appeared in its psychic and spiritual form first in the East, and then flowed on further to the West, where it met with understanding. Thus do we see the further progress of development. In what way was the ego consciousness able so to work in the West that it felt itself related to Christ? What had happened to the souls who had taken up the ego consciousness early? The Egypto-Chaldean people waited to develop the ego in the consciousness soul. The Greco-Romans developed it in the intellectual soul. In Northern Europe, it was prematurely developed in the sentient soul. Because of its early appearance in Northern Europe, the sentient soul and ego consciousness worked together in a different way than elsewhere in the world. What was the result of ego consciousness being firmly established in the sentient soul in Northern Europeans before Christ had entered the development of humanity, and it had taken up what had been developed in Asia? Because this had happened, a force had been developed in the soul of man, including the sentient soul, that could have been developed only through the permeation of the sentient soul while still quite virginal and untouched by other civilizations with the feeling of the ego. This permeation of the sentient soul with the sense of self, that is the ego sense, has grown into man's conscience and accounts for the wonderful innocence of conscience. How does conscience speak to us? It speaks in the simplest and most primitive of men in the same way as it does in the most complex. It simply tells us without theory or dogma what is right and what is wrong, and when it speaks to us, it works on us with the force of an instinct or urge. You will, however, only find conscience developed in this way in the West. It threw its first rays, like those of a rosy dawn, toward Greece and later toward Rome, where it was indeed strongly developed. We first meet with the word conscience, conscientia, in the works of Roman writers, whereas among the Greeks we find only the first sporadic hints of conscience in Euripides. It was used generally by the Romans, who were quite familiar with it. This came about through the influence of the culture of the Northern Europeans that arose through the mutual interpermeation of the sentient soul by the ego feeling. In them, the ego feeling, which lifts men up from the lowest to the highest, already spoke in the sentient soul like a voice from God. Before this, nothing spoke in them but instincts, desires, and passions, but now, like a voice from God, they were urged to do right so that they might rise to the higher ego. In this way, we can trace the first rise of conscience among the peoples of Europe. From there, it spreads its rays abroad to the other peoples of the earth. Thus, through the wise guidance of the world, humanity in one part of the world was so prepared that conscience could be contributed to its collective development. We have mentioned everything that can throw light upon conscience, including that indefinable attribute, its pushing forth from the depths of the soul. Conscience speaks like a persistent impulse, but it is not an impulse. Philosophers who describe it so miss the mark by far. It speaks with elemental, original force, yet with the same force as does the consciousness soul when it appears. So we see that love appears on earth in the East, conscience in the West. The two belong together. As Christ appears in the East, so conscience awakens in the West, that through it Christ may be accepted. In the simultaneous occurrence and comprehension of the fact of the Christ event, and in the preparation for these things in different parts of the earth, we see the rule of an infinite wisdom guiding our development. We have thus indicated the history of conscience. When we recall what has often been emphasized, that now, after the conclusion of Kali Yuga, we are going through a transition in which new forces will have to be developed, we shall easily understand that we are faced with important questions regarding the further development of conscience. In the last lecture, we strongly and clearly emphasized the fact that we are advancing toward a new Christ event. The soul will become capable of perceiving the Christ by means of a certain etheric clairvoyance and of re-experiencing in itself the event of Damascus. We are therefore justified in saying what will happen regarding the experience of the development of conscience in future epochs. We will consider this question next Sunday. The best way to celebrate our White Lotus Day will be to point out the living nature of the movement of spiritual science and to explain that the conscience of man is in a state of transition. We shall see that light can be thrown on it from many different sides. The public lecture will treat the subject quite exoterically, but even in these lectures, since they have continued for many years, many things can now be mentioned. Conscience can be spoken of in a deep sense, as we have done today, or quite exoterically, as we shall do on Thursday, or it may be explored even more profoundly. It will be some time, however, before we can do that. The end of Lecture 6.